So I wasn't really quite sure what to talk about. And as Nayesh said, I mean, I was really invited here to give a plank talk that Kendrick invited me long enough ago that it was totally clear that the plank results would be out by now. And they're not, but we have been giving talks, and there's a list of stuff that I'm allowed to say, which I will say tomorrow. And then it's also awkward because tomorrow I'm assuming that there'll be like condensed matter people or something might come by mistake, not right. So I will have to explain a little bit about what the CMB is. But for today's audience, I'm going to basically assume that you know already, otherwise you wouldn't be here, based on the title. So if you really don't understand what the CMB is, then you have to come tomorrow and then build a time machine and then watch today's talk or something, right? Or read your email, and it's recorded, I guess, right? So read your email and watch it. Watch it on Thursday or something. So I wasn't quite sure what to talk about today. So what I've done is, since I've spent a long time thinking about the cosmic microwave background, I thought I would just throw together a bunch of sort of quirky fun things that I've thought about or worked on a little bit. Almost nothing in this talk matters in some sense. It's all bits and pieces of little. So I hope, and I won't get through everything I've planned, so I'll just stop at some point. So I'm hoping that everybody in the room will will learn something that they didn't know before, at least even if it's the stupid thing that they can tell their friends about in the bar tonight. Let me tell you the stupidest thing I heard today. So maybe that'll be the case. So let me start with a little potted history of the CMB, right? So it's 50 years old. This is the 50th anniversary of Penzias and Wilson. Canada likes to claim that it was detected in the 1940s by stellar astronomers who didn't really know what they were looking at, but that's the Canadian version of the story. And then there's a long history, and we end up with Planck. So the Planck map of the sky, which I will talk about in more detail tomorrow, looks like this, and you reduce that typically to the power spectrum, and the new Planck-only power spectrum looks like this. So a very impressive demonstration of these acoustic peaks and so on. The CMB spectrum, which is what the sort of half-initiated people think you're talking about when you talk about the spectrum, right, is the actual frequency spectrum that looks like this. So this is a combination of data from the Kobe fire ass experiment, which is still the best, and the UBC rocket experiment under here, which I always have to mention because I'm from UBC, and a whole bunch of other experiments. So over about four decades in wavelength or frequency, this is a basically precise black body. And people used to work a lot on the spectrum and spectral distortions, and they moved away from that because nobody found anything very interesting. So this is, you know, so good that it's basically the best black body that we know about. You can't make as good a black body. This is a cornerstone of the hot Big Bang. Nobody knows how to do this except in a model in which the entire universe used to be hot and dense. So this is the sort of key fact that makes you think that the hot Big Bang model is correct. But other than that, we don't talk very much about the spectrum anymore, but we talk about these anisotropies, which you only get when you've removed this, what we call the monopole. So the temperature of the entire sky is 2.7255 Kelvin. It's known extremely precisely. You have to subtract that off to see the dipole, which I'll talk about a little later, and then the anisotropies. But let's talk a little bit about this CMB sky that we're looking at, and I like to make this analogy with an inside-out star. So here's us living in the center of the universe, right? So everybody, you know when you teach undergraduates about cosmology that they already know that they're at the center of the universe, so this isn't a surprise to them, right? And then as you look out in redshift, you're looking further away, but also back in time. So redshift is a time coordinate as well as a distance coordinate. Yes. Oh, questions. That's good.
Did you write this April Fool's paper that said that
did Right, an April Fool's paper. Did you like the ADS-CFT thing?
Yeah. Right, was that you who wrote that?
That was my colleague wrote that, and I helped a little bit. But my colleague, Dr. Frolop, wrote that. I have a student called Ali, and actually some people think he's made up. And the next April Fool's thing I would like to write is with my colleague at SFU, who's Andrei Frolov. So I would like to write a paper which is Ali Frolop, Ali and Frolov. And then people have to guess which of these people are real. But yeah, there's another question.
It looks very anti-Copernican.
It's very anti-Copernican, except that everybody's the center of the universe, right? But this is a much better way of thinking about the universe than the other way around, which has, you know, has the edge of the universe in the middle, if you like, right? Anyway, this is the usual picture. The Big Bang is in some distance coordinate, at least is a finite distance away, and is everywhere. So this is, you know, this is, it's better to plot it this way because this is everywhere, is the Big Bang, rather than all students have read in some book that the Big Bang was an explosion and they all picture a point. And as soon as you picture a point for the Big Bang, you're stuffed. Because then you start thinking about things that don't make sense, right? So almost all questions that I get asked about cosmology from people learning are because they don't have this picture. So this is a bad, you know, even although you might think it's anti-Copernican, it's much better to think of the Big Bang being everywhere. In the standard hot Big Bang model, right, the early universe was hot. It got cool enough at some point that it went from being plasma to neutral. That phase transition is the last scattering surface. So you can contrast that then with a star, right? So here we are living outside a star which is wrapped all around us. So this is the center of the star. This is the surface of the star, the photosphere. Inside the star is plasma, outside the star is neutral. There's an optical depth unity region where you're seeing between those two things. So the universe is exactly like an inside-out star. So all you have to do to picture what the CMB is to picture the sun and then just turn it inside out and wrap it all the way around you. It's pretty straightforward how you picture that. So let me come to that in one sec, because you can push the analogy further if you're like me, and what you do for a living is just have fun messing about with physics and astrophysics. So I wrote a paper actually with an undergrad, a pretty good undergrad. We wrote a little fun paper over the summer, and then Adam Moss, who was a postdoc at the time, helped write the paper, really, actually. And then I stuck my name on it. I forget what I did. There's a close analogy between, not just between the star and the CMB, so between CMBology, as it's sometimes called, and helioseismology or asteroseismology, because people who study the interiors of stars use the waves that are propagating on the surface to learn about the interior. So this is exactly what we're doing with the CMB. So, you know, we use the same spherical harmonic modes for stars that are also radial modes that we don't normally talk about. And for the CMB, we study these anisotropies by squaring the amplitudes of these modes and plotting it as a function of L. There's no special direction, so the M's you can average over because they don't tell you anything. For stars, you actually look at these things oscillating in real time, and then you discuss the frequency in hertz, right, or millihertz, versus the mode numbers, right? These indices L, M, and N for the angular and radial modes. And there are all these families that tell you about the structure of the sun and whether it's rotating because one direction waves go faster than the other. And there's all this phenomenology, which is really the same, except for a number of fundamental differences, which are on the next slide, which will hopefully answer the question that was asked before. So just to push it a little bit further, right, the sun, 6,000 Kelvin, the universe, 3,000 Kelvin. So the universe is in stellar astronomy notation is like a K giant, right? A really big giant. But it's a K star, right? It's a pretty normal, wimpy, slightly lower temperature than the Sun star. The photosphere here is pretty thin because it's actually the edge of the stuff, mostly, which is, you know, there really is an edge to the Sun. The photosphere here is because you're seeing this phase transition. The density doesn't really change dramatically, right? It's just changing like 1 plus Z cubed. So this photosphere is much thicker. Optical depth, unity, and then delta.
By definition, it was 1, then that was all photosphere, but not that.
There's a visibility function, which is, you know, e to the minus tau d tau. Uh-huh. Tau is optical depth, and what's the thickness of that function? It's some bell-shaped function.
But then they said 0.1, that's 0.1%, that's the actual thickness.
Of it. Yeah, yeah. So the photosphere of the Sun is really thin compared to the size of the Sun, right? And this, you know, the redshift width of the universe is 10% of the redshift, right? You know, opacity is complicated, Thomson scattering. Universe is about a billion photons per atom. Here, there's about a billionth of a photon per atom in the photosphere of the Sun, so it's different, you know. Rotation defines a special axis, right? There's a fundamental mode in radius, fundamental mode in time, right? And that's inflation and stuff is in here. Information comes from frequencies, from power spectra. Actually, the solar guys throw away the amplitude because there's no good theory for the amplitude because it's a nonlinear. You know, the modes are rung all the time by solar convection and so on, and then the modes build up in amplitude until nonlinear feedback processes damp them down. All of that stuff is too complicated, and there's no good theory for it. So they don't even use the amplitude at all, which is sort of bizarre from a CMB perspective. The variability here is about 5 minutes. The variability here is really long. And I'll talk about that more in a second. Sorry? At recombination. This is sort of, yeah, thinking about it inside out. Oh yeah, so that was your question, which I tried to ignore by not answering it. I mean, the Sun's water, right? Right? And I'm an astronomer, so you can spare me a couple of orders of magnitude, right? And the universe is about one atom per cubic meter, right? And then it's times 10 to the 9. So 10 to the 9 versus Avogadro's number or something, right? So I don't know, 10 to the 15 difference or something. I mean, I'm making this up now, though. There's no serious part of this talk, right? So one thing you can ask about the CMB temperature is where does it come from, right? So a thing that I've done over a bunch of years is collect explanations for this, right? This number, as I've said, is very precisely known. It's the most precisely known number in cosmology, and you know, rivals lots of numbers in physics. So this, you know, and this has been for a while. So it sort of puts paid to the notion that cosmology isn't precise. So you can think up a bunch of goofy stuff. You can realize that it's close to E Kelvin, or the square root of 15 over 2 Kelvin, or 30 over 11 Kelvin is pretty good. These don't have dimensions in them, so these can't be right, because these depend on the units, right? But you can invent things that, you know. So a bunch of my colleagues point out, it's like the triple point of water divided by 100, right? That's a bit freaky. You can do, if you like, the fine structure constant. So then here are things that at least have the correct units. And you can combine all sorts of usual fundamental constants. You can define fine structure constant for gravity in the obvious way, and you can involve that. So this is the closest that I would be, you know, I'm funded by taxpayer dollars, but so I won't tell you how long it took me to figure out that guy. If you like imperial units, it's actually about a micro league in imperial units. converted to Kelvins, right? And then the last one here is that it's about e to the minus 73 times the Planck temperature, where the Planck temperature is the Planck energy and temperature units. And I actually got this in an email from a guy. I mean, I already knew this, but he pointed out that pi e to the pi is 73. So it's e to the minus pi e to the pi Planck units, right? Which is, you know, this one usually gets the biggest laughs, right? And that's sort of amusing because it turns out that that one's actually correct. So you can ask, you know, where did the CMB really come from?
But so all of them are correct. What do you mean
the last one is actually physically correct, right? As we'll see, right? So the photons were probably made during, you know, nuclear synthesis and slightly earlier during the annihilation of stuff that made photons. So that's where most of the photons came from, if you like. They're last scattered here in the history of the universe, but they're not, you know, created or annihilated, unless you think that scattering is a creation and annihilation at the same time. So they're sort of made here and scattered here. But the physics that sets why the CMB temperature is what it is, you know, whatever the physics of inflation is that defines a time and a reheating temperature at that time. So that's some inflationary fundamental physics thing, which we don't know yet. We can't predict what that number is. But in principle, if we understood all the physics, we could say inflation does the following thing. The reheat temperature is this at a time after the Big Bang in an extrapolated Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, which would be this. And then all of the rest of particle physics just annihilates particles. Whoops, sorry, what did I do there? Just annihilates particles until you end up with the CMB last scattering in, right? So the thing that sets the CMB temperature today is basically how many expansion factors has there been between today and the inflationary scale. So that last one is where the CMB temperature comes from. It is e to the minus 73 times the Planck time. Right? So T naught comes from the reheat temperature, standard model particle annihilation, and then the age of the universe today, which is like a clock. And that e to the minus 73 is basically some number like 10 to the minus 28. So the scale factor for inflation in the standard model is about 10 to the minus 28. Compared to the scale factor of unity today, right? And it's that this number plus the physics of inflation plus all the rest of particle physics that makes the CMB temperature 2.72, right? But plus what time is it, right? Because if we wait a while, it'll be lower. So in principle, if we knew what time it was and we knew all of the rest of physics, right, we could predict the CMB temperature. But right now, it's just an empirical thing that we measure. There's a slightly freaky thing that comes when you think about this for a little longer, and this really worried me for a bit. So if I think about the future, in the future of the lambda CDM model, which is the standard model of cosmology, we will eventually approach the time when the vacuum to which you can assign a temperature has the same temperature as the CMB. The CMB drops temperature all the time until it basically gets to the vacuum temperature. At that time, it turns out it's the same epoch, it's the same physics, as when the wavelength of radiation is like the Hubble scale. Okay, so when you were trying to measure CMB photons, but their waves are so long that they're basically the size of the observable universe, so you can't really define a temperature at all, right? Then that's about the same time at which that the CMB energy density is equal to the lambda energy density, right? So that's called the Gibbons-Hawking temperature normally, and for any horizon. So this is the Gibbons-Hawking temperature for the future horizon that you get in a lambda model, right? And in appropriate units, it's just the Hubble parameter over 2 pi, and of course the Hubble parameter in a lambda model is approaching a constant, right? So the Hubble constant today is about 70, or if you want to be more precise, the first digit is 6 according to Planck, and some other number according to people that think they measure the Hubble constant for a living. And we'll approach about 55 or something in the infinite future, right? And you can work out what the temperature is. So the joke is, Sandage is right. He was just 50 billion years ahead of his time, right? It's the usual joke. I didn't want to, I said that joke too many times. I didn't want to, but you could be the straight man.
There you go. I think he's the only one who knows what you're talking about.
Nobody's heard of Sandage here because they're all born before. So if you work out the Gibbons-Hawking scale factor, right? What's the scale factor in the lambda model at which this thing that I've just talked about happens? It's about 10 to the 28. And then it really perplexed me for a week or something that this is 1 over this. And then, so from that perspective, it seems like it's kind of freaky that in terms of exponentially expanding vacuum-dominated periods in the history of the universe, we live at the geometric mean of the two things, right? And it's a little bit freaky, but it is a fact, right?
That's probably why Pandas came up with this idea of, like, the universe gets too big, it's impressive in the scale.
Don't ask me to say anything about Penrose, because I've... Yeah. Had already had arguments with Penrose about circles in the sky and stuff, and I don't know. I did meet him at a conference not very long ago, and he did talk to me. But there wasn't much evidence from the email interactions before that he would do so.
Popular number V folds, C^-60
and C^-73. Yeah, but so that's no, because there's also the thing since then, right? No, that's less speculative, right? Yeah. There's the usual FRW expansion, right?
This is post-inflation expansion of the universe.
Yeah, which. Yeah, so that's a slightly different but related thing.
Depends on which model.
Yeah, exactly. But that's not what this calculation is, right? This calculation is speculative and crazy and not very helpful to anybody, right? I agree, but not as speculative as that, because it's just FRW, right? It's just how many e-folds has there been since the end of inflation to now, right? And that you can work out for, you know, you have to put in a reheat temperature for inflation and something, right? So put in some round numbers.
Inflation happens after Planck time. So if you go all the way back to Planck time, you get 73 folds, but if you go to the end of inflation, it would be 60 folds. So that's the difference. So or less.
And you go from BBN to now, you get the definition.
Yeah.
And
any means.
Anyway, so I've just told you that we live at this geometric mean, but actually, the reason that I'd stopped worrying about this after a week, not that I worried like very much about this, but. You can figure out that, you know, the inflationary scale factor is just this ratio, right? Which you could rewrite as that if you like. The Gibbons-Hawking scale factor is this ratio, which is approximately that. But remember that density is H naught squared, and there's a G in here, which just is Planck mass squared, or 1 over Planck mass squared. So you can rewrite H naught by rewriting this guy as this, and then rewrite that as this. And what that means is that the Gibbons-Hawking scale factor is actually this, right? And that means that it's the Gibbons-Hawking scale factor is 1 over this guy up to this ratio, which in usual people's thinking is not a very big ratio, right? It's a couple of orders of magnitude or something. And so is this, so is that, right? Oh, what did I just do? And so is the other ratio, right? In fact. So it's not only just that this guy is 1 over this guy, but actually this guy is about that guy too, right? So the only coincidence really is that this ratio is about this ratio. And this, the big coincidence is actually not even a coincidence. If you actually work through what you knew already, it was already there. So it's not freaky that we live at the geometric mean between those two things. It's you already knew that. So I'll leave you to ponder whether that's a thing that you're going to ever worry about again for the rest of your life. And move on to a totally different topic, which is how much the universe, the CMB, is going to change as the universe evolves. So here is a movie showing the development of CMB anisotropies as a function of scale factor, right? So you end up with, when the scale factor gets to one, with what looks like the familiar CMB anisotropies. So you can, and down here are tensor modes. So you can work through this in detail and actually just figure out how it evolves. And then a question is, you know, how does the CMB evolve today? Right? If we look tomorrow, we fully expect, you know, the Planck year one maps and the Planck year two maps are going to be essentially identical. But you know, the universe is evolving, so there will come a time when they won't be identical. So can you actually figure out how to do that? And I actually spent a while thinking about this and failing to make progress. And then Adam Moss arrived as a new postdoc, and I explained this problem to him. And he said, so what, you know, presumably you worked out the unequal time correlators, and there was just a problem interpreting that or something? And I said, yeah, that's it. But the unequal time correlators, I got that part. But then it was just a problem with implementing the code or something, right? So all you do is work out the unequal time correlators, and it's trivial. So that's what smart postdocs are for. He probably still thinks that I understood that all along. So don't, anybody knows him, don't tell him that it was all his idea. Nobody watches these videos. So you can, I hope. Yeah, so then you can project into the future, and here's the CMB sky, today's CMB sky, projected, I think we go to scale factor 10 or something. So what you see is, you know, big changes in large scales, that's the so-called integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, the potentials are changing. So there's a large scale thing, which is the low L increase. What you can't see on here is that the small scales also change subtly, because if you like, more stuff is coming inside the horizon. So that if you think about a space-time diagram, you're moving up. So there's, you know, the fixed surface is moving back in some way of measuring coordinates. So there's really cosmic variance in the CLs. There are cosmic variance in the CLs. Yeah, at small scales, right? So the large scales, it's basically the same structure, except that they're being amplified by integrated Sachs-Wolfe, but it's the same structures. Yeah.
So can I ask, so this is one particular realization?
This was like the WMAP map, so the actual realization.
And then as time evolves,
you add just the right amount of Gaussianly correlated additional structure. You make it up, but it's constrained to be today, and then you just add this, you rotate the matrix and add a row and then unrotate the matrix. Does that make sense? And Adam probably explained how to do that too.
Do you add random noise to it or not?
Yeah, no, that's noise free, just to be, but you could do that if you want to. We wrote two papers on this, so if you want to write a third paper on this topic, it's... completely fine, but two seemed like enough already. It's like at least one paper too many, actually. The dipole also changes in time, right? And that's because we're going around the Milky Way. So actually, if you did this for real, you would see the dipole changing much faster than the CMB anisotropies, right? So you can work out, you know, how long would you have to wait? I'm pressing the wrong button here. How long would you have to wait before you could see, before, you know, the significance is big enough, and, you know, this is with noise, clever noise filtering, so you could wait about 10 years, you could see the dipole changing, so you could actually measure us going around the Milky Way, you know, actually move, with, you know, which has already been done with radio VLBI, actually, but you could do the same thing with the CMB. You would need, you know, a super-duper Planck with careful statistical analysis, but in principle, you could do this in decades. But to see the other anisotropies beyond the dipole changing, it's really thousands of years, even for an ideal experiment. So it really changes very slowly. So what's going on here is, obviously, the monopole is decreasing all the time, so it's harder and harder to measure the CMB anisotropies, right, and eventually approaching this de Sitter temperature. Dipole oscillates as we orbit the galaxy. The anisotropies evolve because of this decay of temperature, but also projection effects, new structure coming inside the horizon, and this ISW. But the CMB eventually becomes a frozen star, which is an analogy back to the inside-out star thing. So there is this horizon. So it's actually worse in a lambda model than it would be otherwise, because it really does just stop evolving. I mean, you're seeing exactly the same structure forever. It's just getting colder, right, on large scales. The new structure coming side is the dominant effect for small changes in time, but it would take millennia to detect. And then in practice, if you really think about this, the changing foregrounds would be a huge practical issue, because in the same time, all that dust and stuff that messes up trying to measure B modes and everything, right, it's going to completely confuse trying to measure a changing CMB. So you would never do this because the Milky Way is changing faster than the CMB is. But of course, you know, if we're being crazy, all you have to do is leave the Milky Way and you don't have to worry about foregrounds at all. And you could, you know, 1,000 years, you could build a thing now that would leave the plane of the Milky Way in 1,000 years if you tried really hard. So we could certainly do that. Yeah. Another related question that we can ask is yeah, you need to go way out in L, right? So you need to imagine that you can go to really high L where the differences are the biggest, right? There's more new structure coming in, right? And this is, I mean, the thing that you see changing is the ALMs, right? Not the CLs. It's not a cosmic variance thing. It's the actual modes changing.
Yeah. I mean, even at fixed L, there's no fundamental limit.
No cosmic variance, you're correct, right? Yeah. Yeah, so you're absolutely free to write the fourth paper on this topic, because there was already another one, right? So
and
it's all good. Yeah, you have a long time before anybody cares. Right? So, so another question that you could ask is, the CMB temperature is a certain thing. What about the temperature of the rest of the universe, right? So a thing that we realized that we could write up, and this is other than April Fool's papers, this is the shortest paper I ever wrote, because I think it was a page. We actually had a battle with the journal, because the journal thought it was too short to publish. And the referee said, it's a kind of pointless paper, but it's only a page. So then, there was a long debate over a page. You know, I mean, give me a break. It's just put it in the archive and be done with it, is that right? So the matter in the universe is tied to the CMB because of scattering until it's not, and then it evolves adiabatically, but it's a gamma five-thirds gas rather than a gamma four-thirds gas, if that means anything to anybody here. I did this with my fourth year undergrad class last week, and they'd never heard of gamma, and I said, ratio of specific heats? Nah. And I tried several other things. But anyway, send them to Waterloo, where the audience is much more sophisticated. So for radiation, right, the temperature goes like 1 plus Z, or it goes like 1 over the scale factor. For matter, right, because it has this different behavior, right, it goes like 1 plus Z squared. So the matter would be much colder today, except for being tied to the radiation. So you can ask, how cold would the universe be today if there had been no structure in the universe? And you can do this precisely because you have all the cosmological parameters. So you can actually run the chain and figure out how cold the universe would be. And the answer is about 21 millikelvin, right? So if there had been no structure in the universe today, and in fact, you know, the matter in the universe is heated by a combination of shocking in the intergalactic medium gas and radiation that puts energy in. So most of the stuff in the universe is actually more than 10 to the 4 Kelvin, right? Somewhere between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 6 or 7 maybe Kelvin. There's a range of temperatures. But if there had been no structure, which is the thing that heats the universe, the matter in the universe would have been only 20 millikelvin, right? And you can take the ratio of this to the CMB temperature, and that tells you the redshift at which they depart, which is about 125, which is a bit lower than most people think. So the matter in the universe was basically tied to the CMB temperature till about redshift 125, and then it decayed like an extra power of 1 plus Z. But then, you know, and it maybe it got to about the CMB temperature, today's CMB temperature, a few Kelvin, and then structure formed and it went ballistic, right? So that's actually the history of matter. I can't think of any consequence at all for this number. But the fact that you can work it out, and I'd never seen it written down, was merited a page, in my view, and so we did. Right? So there it is. I think it's never been cited, this paper. But that's more, you know, that's more, or maybe I cited it once, just more citations per page than some of my best papers, which it's always your best papers that nobody cites. Let me talk a little more about the monopole. A thing that you can ask is, you know, is everybody measuring the same monopole? What does the monopole mean? Kendrick mentioned cosmic variance, which is the idea that there's different realizations in different patches, right? So, you know, is there a cosmic variance in the monopole? So we know that this is tricky because the monopole is a gauge-dependent thing. So your monopole and my monopole can differ if I slice space-time differently. So in particular, if I go around densities or something, right, then I will get a different answer than you. So in other words, the monopole that we measure inside the Milky Way is slightly different than the monopole outside because there's a gravitational change inside the Milky Way to outside, which is a thing. So you know already when you think about it that means that it's tricky to define exactly what you mean by the monopole. So the reason that this is sort of an interesting thing to think about, though, is because you know that fluctuations are about 1 part in 10 to the 5, okay? And we could live in some excursion that's not terribly unlikely, like 3 sigma or something, right? So you know, once you get to the fourth digit on this guy, you're starting to wonder about what you mean by the monopole. And the temperature is actually measured so precisely that we're not very far off having to worry about that. We're about an order of magnitude away, which means that if you're the sort of person who worries about crazy things, then you should worry about it now, right? And get a paper in before it matters. Right? So what does this really mean? What's going on here? So in principle, you could go to the black body store now and buy a black body measuring machine, mm-hmm. and you could do 10 times better than FIREAS, okay. Without too much trouble if you really wanted to pour some money on it. And then you would have to wonder what, right? But I think you should already wonder exactly what you mean. So you can define a monopole, and you can talk about the variance of the monopole. So you can talk about how much the monopole varies, even if the actual individual values of the monopole depend on how you defined what you mean. So you can calculate a transfer function for the monopole and for the higher order multiples, which we'd just never seen before, so we did it, right? So this is, the solid line is the transfer function for the dipole, which I'd also never seen plotted. These are the transfer functions for the higher order multiples, which is in all the books. It's the standard thing. But these are perfectly well defined, the monopole and the dipole transfer functions. In other words, how much contribution you get to the variance as a function of scale. So you can actually talk about that, even although the value of the monopole is gauge dependent. So you can do the same thing for the dipole and following this same logic. So I wrote a paper with Jim Zibin called Gauging the CMB, which is a fantastic paper. And I can say that because it's almost all Jim's paper. in which you can understand how the dipole and the monopole work by you know going through the whole mechanism of calculating CMB anisotropy is being very careful about gauge. So what you realize is that the dipole is also ambiguous, and it's sort of more obvious for the dipole, because if you're running away from me, it's clear that you will measure a different dipole than I will, but who cares, right? This large contribution comes from small scales, which are nonlinear, and that's the thing that makes the CMB dipole that we see. It comes from stuff in the local universe pulling us and making us move, right? And the super Hubble, super horizon modes are actually suppressed, which makes sense. But people have spent a lot of time talking about intrinsic dipoles, and so you can ask whether they might ever exist. You know, could you have a sort of actual dipole in the sky? And now Mike, who has worked on this, is going to ask a hard question.
I was going to ask, I was going to make a suggestion for a third paper. You did movement around the galaxy, but you did project towards A equals 10 with a large scale contribution to the dipoles.
Okay. That's paper three. We could collaborate on that. We could find a student to do all the work. Okay, good, excellent. We'll talk afterwards. So in principle, people have mentioned, you know, you could work out the real dipole by you know, for example, the aberration in the CMB, right? Which has now been measured by Planck, actually. Or do, you know, what Mike does, which is, you know, you look at all the nearby structures and you figure out what the dipole should be based on all the local accelerations. And then in some sense, if this gives you a different answer than the CMB dipole, then there's an intrinsic dipole, right? So we spent a little while thinking about this. And it turns out to be actually, although you can do arbitrarily complicated looking calculations, what's really going on is very simple. And it's just that if you restrict yourself to adiabatic models, so that means that you perturb the matter in the radiation in the same way, then there's only 1 degree of freedom in the problem. And that means that if I define the CMB rest frame, right, then if I am moving relative to the CMB rest frame, then I will see a dipole. And if I see a dipole, I'm moving with respect to the CMB rest frame. And that's all there is to it. And the only way that you could break those is that you have a giant isocurvature mode, so that the CMB rest frame and the matter rest frame, if you like, you have to define exactly what you mean by that, are not necessarily the same. So in principle, you could have a giant isocurvature mode, which is like having a big tilted thing across the universe. So you could do that, but of course we know that the CMB anisotropies are fantastically well explained by adiabatic perturbations. So you would have to believe that isocurvature perturbations come in big time only on the very biggest scale in the universe. So there's no good motivation for that, but again, you know, there's nothing to stop people writing papers, and they have, right? On ideas for where that could be the case. And people have also talked about these large scale things, and you know, there's papers that I don't believe talking about dark flows, and this persists, people claiming that there's large scale flows in the universe. But you can rule this out using the kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. So the fact that clusters of galaxies, if you like, are seeing their local dipole, and you get a small effect in the distortion in the direction of the cluster of galaxies. The error bars on that per cluster of galaxies is 1,000 or 2,000 kilometers a second currently. But in these models, when there's this giant dipole, the whole sky has this coherent motion. So I can average over all the clusters, and I can rule this out fairly definitively, although not everybody believes that. At the same time, you can also rule out these crazy models in which we live at the center of the universe, right? So somebody was asking about Copernican before, and I'd actually forgotten I was going to talk about Copernicus later. So I think that's supposed to be Copernicus. This is the center of the universe, which is in Idaho. It's the center of the universe in the middle of the road. I think that's also Idaho. It's the center of somebody else's universe. Lots of people think this is the center of the universe. Or this is ley lines converging. That's Roslyn, which is the center of Scottish universe and crazy people. People that come from a city close to here think that kind of thing. Right, there's a cosmology center of the universe. I forget what I put in here, so I'm... This is, Salvador Dali had a center of the universe, which is this station somewhere in, and you need to know more about Dali. And this is my office door, which is this. Look at that. That's what you should be now doing instead of listening to the last 5 minutes of the talk. So it's hard to tell homogeneity from isotropy. So it's hard to tell when you're looking at whether you're seeing something varying in time or something varying in space. So because everything's on the light cone that you observe. So in principle, the cosmological constant might not be the case. It could be that we live in a very underdense region in which everything's streaming out and it looks like lambda. So there's actually been at least 100 papers on this. I haven't kept count, but a very large number of papers on this crazy idea, which is quite extraordinary. We've only written 2 papers on this, but both of them were trying to rule it out, which at least seems sane, right? So the big idea is there's this giant underdense region. It has to be so big and so underdense that it can't be a random fluctuation based on everything else we know about the universe. So you have to assume that that's fine, right? So somehow you have to imagine that there's some extra source of fluctuations that happens to give this extra thing. That's somehow supposed to be okay. We have to live very, very close to the center, otherwise you get a giant dipole, really, really close to the center. And then that has to be also okay. So that's, I found this cool picture of this well in India. I've never been to this well, but I would really like to go now that I've seen the picture. So it's like you imagine that you go down this well eventually, it'd take you a few weeks to get to the bottom. And at the bottom, there's like a giant statue on a pillar or something, right? So I mean, the last thing you expect to find in the bottom of a well is a thing sticking up, right? But this is the picture, right? We live in the bottom of this giant void, but we're a peak in the density field, right?
Why is that lasting?
I mean,
everything falls down the well.
Why is this lasting? So that's another reason, right? So Nyash's reason to not believe the giant void model is because everything would fall into it. So I see this year's April Fool's paper coming. Right? I have to make an anagram of your name, though. It's probably not hard. Okay. So you can do detailed calculations of this, and if you try and fit the CMB and fit other things you know about cosmology, it's actually very hard to make this work properly. You have to not have the universe be flat. You get very low Hubble constants and so on. There's several different things that don't really work very well. So you can, here's the shape of the void. We ran all these Monte Carlo simulations with arbitrary shaped profiles. And then you can try and fit the CMB, and it doesn't work very well unless you allow the Hubble constant to be very low and the density of the universe to not be flat, right? Which is what the motivation was in the first place. Let me not go into that in detail. But then the newer Planck results are, right, you would need to be down here to explain this stuff, and the lack of a KSZ monopole, right, allows you to restrict these things at such low, such bad chi-square that you can't even quite do the calculations, right? So these don't only, not slightly fit, they just don't fit. And the reason is because in this model, as you look out in redshift at clusters of galaxies, they should all be streaming away from us. So every single galaxy at reasonable distances has 1,000 kilometers a second outward flow. And the error bars are 1,000 kilometers a second, but there's a lot of clusters. So there is just no kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich monopole, and you can rule out that view of looking at the universe. And I'm just reminded of the fact that it's the same temperature here as it was in Vancouver when I left, except using 2 different temperature scales. So, you know, some of us do live in a special place, I think. There's another question, and I should stop in a minute.
Yeah, regarding this, since I invented this model, I do have to defend this.
You and 20 other people, I would say, but I'd, but
I think I published the first
paper. The first paper? Okay.
Yeah, the problem is the Hamilton bonding model is very special. It has no pressure.
Yeah.
You don't put in pressure radiation to make it go.
Yeah, so this is what, so Jim Zibin, who's the postdoc I work with, who can do difficult problems, but I can't. So he's written papers on numerically extending LTB to include these other components, which is hard to do, but those calculations are based on that numerical model, which is
also,
correct, I believe. There's a bunch of stuff in the literature about this bang time, which I don't understand. Doesn't mean I don't believe so. It's complete crackpot craziness, and that's coming from me. So I don't think there's any. I don't think you can make any progress with this bang time thing. Sorry? Yeah, but the difference is he wasn't. That's the difference. Let me end with a little aside. I'm sorry, I'm picking on the. So this is a quote from one of my favorite philosophers, who's called Douglas Adams. So I was trying to think a little about how big the universe is. Maybe we'll end with this topic. So the observable universe is about 300 yotta meters. And yotta is the largest SI prefix, so if you didn't know it already, the way that you remember how big the yotta is that you, because you know how big the universe is, it's the unit that you need to describe in meters how big the universe is, right? So that's the way to remember. It's not the way normal people remember, but that's how cosmologists remember. So it's 10 to the 24. You don't need 1,000 yotta meters, because there aren't 1,000 yotta meters in the observable universe, right? So it is, I don't know whether that's why it was chosen, but there it is. But how big is the whole universe, not just the observable universe, right? So one thing that you can make progress on is asking how many Hubble patches that there could be, right? So in particular, my old friend Max Tegmark, who I was joking with, this is taped, so I have to watch what I'm saying. But Max used to have a thing on his website that said for every 20 sensible papers he wrote, he would write one crazy paper. And I met him not very long ago, and I said, hey, Max, I see your ratio is still 20 to 1. It's the other way around. So Max likes to talk about the whole universe and infinities and stuff. So he has a classification of, you know, bigness for multiverse and quantum mechanical many worlds and various things. And what he likes to claim is that in the standard cosmological picture, since we think the universe is infinite or as near as damn it, right, that already means that there are an infinite number of Hubble patches. And that means that even without needing to think quantum many worlds or multiverse with bubble inflation or whatever, right, even the standard cosmology, there are patches out there in which I'm as funny as Douglas Adams or something, right? Which is, you know, you'd have to go pretty far, but there you go. So according to Max, there's as many patches in this infinite standard cosmological picture as there are in the quantum many worlds picture. So you're already, and he's trying to claim this so that the next thing he talks about doesn't seem as freaky, because you've already sort of, in a thing that you believed, you've already accepted that there's an infinite number of things. First of all, I don't have to believe Max, because I he was a grad student when I was a postdoc, so I'd like really Max? No, right. So I would like to not believe this. So you can do a calculation which says how many Hubble patches are there in the universe, and now that we have the model worked out with the parameters, right? I can work out what the answer to this is. And of course, So I can draw a likelihood function where, and this is sort of the most sensible way to plot this, I think, which is that this is the likelihood versus the number of universes, by which I mean the ratio of the total volume of the universe divided by the volume of the Hubble patch. Right? And of course, I've only drawn half the likelihood here, okay? Because, I was going to try and show that first. Because there's a delta function here at infinity, right? So this half the likelihood is in open models, right? So the universe seems very close to flat, but half the likelihood is in open models. So when I integrate over this whole thing, I get half here, essentially, and this is the other half. Okay, so I can't tell you how many universes there are, but I can put a limit on the number of universes. So I can say that there's at least, right, on this side, I can put, you know, I can make the 5% thing here. And the fact that this is 50% doesn't matter, right? So I can say there has to be at least some number of Hubble patches, assuming that the standard model is correct and that we don't live in a freaky part of the universe, right? That it's representative. And the question is, what is that number? Right? And the number, when we did this a few years ago, I have not redone this for Planck. The number is more like 50 or something, I think. But when we did this, the number was 21, right? And 21 is a lot less than 10 to the 100, okay? So standard cosmology requires me, standard cosmology plus reasonable assumptions like we're in a normal part of, right, requires me to have tens of Hubble patches. But the universe could be spatially closed and it's all there is, right? Or there could be hundreds or thousands or millions, I don't know. But I'm only required for there to be tens. Okay, and again, this is a thing that doesn't matter, but it argues with max, so it's fun to do, right? So that means that, you know, if you want to believe that somewhere out there there's a Hubble patch that differs by only a few bits from this Hubble patch, that's when you need the 10 to the 100, right? Right, but if there's only 10 Hubble patches or 50 or 1,000 or a million, they're all different, right? And there is no Hubble patch in which you are, you know, Douglas Adams or whoever your favorite person that you would like to be. I don't know, depending what kind of thing you follow. And I probably follow with, I'm Scottish, and Andy Murray is the sports person I could find recently that's Scottish that's doing anything. Although Scotsmen aren't supposed to be able to play tennis, as any Monty Python fan knows. And I think I'm probably out of time and I will stop. So thank you. It's fun to think about all these. So don't let me try and make it seem like I don't think people should think about void models and everything.
The problem is that when you look at the angle of the perspective, it dazzles you. It's so good. However, there are issues involved. For example, dark energy, meaning of lambda. We haven't detected dark matter.
We have detected dark matter.
What?
We have detected dark matter.
Have you published this paper?
There's thousands of papers on detections of dark matter.
John,
oh, you have to like hold it and give it a name for it to be. I thought like detecting it was enough, but maybe I'm. There's not very shiny stuff in the universe, I'm absolutely convinced.
You have to find the part.
No, I'm a cosmologist. I know exactly what the dark matter is. It's cold dark matter. I'm done, right? I'm not a particle physicist.
I'm impressed by the fact that we know these things so well.
Excellent. I'm usually very, very skeptical. I took a long time to come round to lambda. So I was writing papers on trying to avoid lambda after most other people were, because I just thought it was too freaky to believe, but there you go. I think it's incontrovertible now that there's a kind of dark energy that looks just like vacuum energy, and there you are. I don't think you can avoid that. Yeah.
So on the topic of lambda, the
lambda.
Says that the fact that we're geometric mean between
theta. Oh, yeah. Well, you're worrying now.
Beginning of the inverse, you say, you know, that's not even a coincidence, but isn't the reason that that last factor is order one exactly what's called the cosmic coincidence?
Yeah, but the big coincidence is the ratio of the temperature today to the inflationary energy or something, right? That's a lot of powers of 10, right?
Okay.
So that's the bit, that's 10 to the 20 something. And the other, the little thing is only a couple of orders of magnitude. So that's a coincidence, but it's a pretty, it's a little coincidence, right?
Okay.
Compared to the usual coincidence problem, which is, right, why do we live at the time when, right? That's usually thought about as a much worse fine-tuning issue. Well, it depends what you think the coincidence problem is.
I mean, I think you could probably cast that one coincidence problem.
You could, yeah. There's probably a version of the coincidence problem which is the same as this thing. You're probably correct, right? But when I think coincidence problem, I'm thinking of people trying to figure out why lambda is the energy density that it is, rather than 10 to the some huge number different, right? And that's a big fine-tuning problem, which is not in this thing, right? I don't know if that helps, but now you'll be able to sleep at night now and not worry that you've been picked on.
I can ask you something. So there are a lot of, this is a cosmology seminar, a lot of young people in the audience who are just wondering whether cosmology might be the right choice for their future career. I'm just wondering whether your talk helped with that.
It's not a question. It's not a question for me. Should we have a vote? I think it's fantastically fun to think about the whole universe, and that's
right.
What I do for a living is mostly fun, and I get paid by the government to do that, and I feel incredibly fortunate that I can do this, right? Because I'm not curing cancer or curing the world's hunger problems or.
More progress that...
Oh, that's a different coming. That's a different question.
Well, but that's what they're going to be working on, right?
Yeah, I think it's a miserable time to be a theorist in cosmology, because it's very unclear what to work on next.
I think the exact opposite.
You do?
It's right, but there are huge opportunities, there are huge problems. So.
You need to be smart or lucky or something. I mean, there's huge problems, but there's no... No,
there
I would say it was pretty clear... The last few decades, there were things where it was clear there was a thing to work on that was going to be solved, right? I mean, we figured out that the dark matter had to be cold dark matter, right? So there was a time when there was a big debate, and you could work on that, and you knew that progress was going to come. And then, you know, as John says, we don't know what the particle is, so that's a whole other thing. But we have no inkling. I mean, people have... Dark matter has a slightly different property. The cusps in the centers of galaxies are slightly different or something. I don't, that's not very good motivation. There's no reason to think that's dark matter properties. Cosmological constant might be dark energy. If you're optimistic, you might be able to determine that W isn't -1. That would be fantastic, right? Somebody might come up with a theory that is you know, attractive and well-motivated and we all get excited by. But there's thousands of papers on, and none of them are very valuable, right? Right. Primordial magnetic fields, they probably don't exist. There's 1,000 papers on that, right? Pamela comes out and there's 1,000 papers because theorists don't know what else to work on, and right, maybe it's particle physics. And, right?
Bicep
2, and my R might be 0.2, and right? So if you hit the winner, then there are some giant problems to solve, but it's not clear to me how to go about solving any of them currently, but as I say, I think you have a lot of fun in the meantime, and that's right. It's fantastic to think about. So,
and you might get lucky and discover the idea.
You might, right? I mean, you know, tomorrow somebody might detect the dark matter particle in the lab, and then it might be connected to some particular version of supersymmetry, and next week. Right, the dark matter problem is completely done, right? And then the week after that, some string theorist says the only thing lambda can be is the following, and somebody works it out, and it makes sense, and it's this particular rolling scalar field, and that's done. Right? So that is possible, right? But it's also possible that 50 years from now, neither of these things will have been solved dramatically. I can't tell. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.